From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The president feels very confident, both in the steps that he's taken. He also feels very confident in knowing that these steps are going to be good for the country. That despite some of the concerns that have been raised by Republicans, we know that these steps are going to strengthen national security. They're going to strengthen security at the border. They are going to strengthen our economy. And they will do something to address a lingering problem, which is the millions of people who currently live in this country who can come out of the shadows, can get right with the law, they can pay their taxes, they can go to the back of the line, but also sort of become fully contributing members of communities large and small all across the country. This is an important step that will have a pretty profound impact on the lives of millions of people who live here.
That was White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest Wednesday at his daily press conference discussing the president's planned announcement Thursday night of a number of actions on immigration that he plans to implement by executive order. According to the New York Times late Wednesday, when the president speaks to the nation in a primetime address Thursday evening, he will assert his authority to provide legal status for up to 5 million undocumented immigrants, setting in motion an immediate confrontation with Republicans about the limit of the president's executive powers. A video was posted at the White House website Wednesday afternoon where the president outlined the purpose of Thursday's address from the White House.
Tomorrow night, I'm going to be announcing here from the White House some steps that I can take to start fixing our broken immigration system. Everybody agrees that our immigration system is broken. Unfortunately, Washington has allowed the problem to fester for too long. And so what I'm going to be laying out is the things that I can do with my lawful authority as president to make the system work better, even as I continue to work with Congress and encourage them to get a bipartisan, comprehensive bill that can solve the entire problem.
Protesters in Hong Kong clashed with police Wednesday morning as they tried to break into the city's Legislative Council building. We have this report from the Chinese news agency, CCTV.
A small group of protesters attempted to break into the Legislative Council in Hong Kong early Wednesday. Police officers and protesters clashed after they broke several glass doors as they tried to enter the building. The incident came after the Hong Kong High Court granted a restraining order requiring protesters to clear the area in front of the Civic Tower in the city's central area. A separate order was also issued for a second protest site to be cleared in Mong Kok.
CCTV's Wu Li was on the scene and gave this report from the Legislative Council building in Hong Kong.
We are at the outside of the Legislative Council, and the police officers from the investigation team are still taking pictures and trying to get some clues of this violent clash early this morning. And at around 1 o'clock this early morning, a group of young people, many appear to be teenagers, try to crack open the glass doors outside of the canteen of the Legislative Council and have used metal barriers and various objects, including broken bricks, try to smash the glass doors. And the police have been called in immediately, and they have they try to persuade these protesters to retreat, but they didn't listen to, and the police had to use the batons as well as shields and deploy paper spray to fence off the protesters. And the standoff has continued for several hours, and police had taken away four people. The police had condemned this violent clash and reiterated that any act that endangering public order and public safety will not be tolerated, and three police officers have been injured.
Ever since fighting began in Syria back in early 2011, the Syrian government has tried to communicate the message through the haze of Western media that the fighters are not Syrian revolutionaries, but foreign terrorists sent to topple the government with arms and funding from outside the country. Nearly 4 years later, it seems the problem has grown so large that even the UN Security Council is finally admitting it. Daniel Dickinson reports from the United Nations.
The number of foreign terrorist fighters in the Syria and Iraq conflict has grown to more than 15,000. Briefing the Security Council on Wednesday, the UN Secretary General said the fighters come from over 80 different countries. Groups such as the Islamic State, also known as ISIL, and the Al-Nusra Front continue to terrorize communities in the Middle East. ISIL has become infamous for public beheadings, executions, torture, and rape. The UN chief, Ban Ki-moon, said the problem is multifaceted.
The threat of foreign terrorist fighters and the scourge of violent extremism are not just the security challenges, they are also political and development challenges affecting stability and the social fabric of communities, countries, and region. We must continue to think more deeply into the fundamental conditions that allow extremism to thrive. Looking at these challenges solely through a military lens has shown its limits.
At the same meeting, the Security Council repeated its position that terrorism constitutes one of the most serious threats to international peace and security. Daniel Dickinson, United Nations.
Something new from Venezuela. The creation of a workers' bank has been announced by President Nicolas Maduro. Press TV's Jesus Silva reports from Caracas.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro announced the creation of the National Bicentenario Workers' Bank, which is the government's biggest investment in the state-owned financial system. The bank will provide special financial services to the working class, women, and members of the commune movement.
Our people are in the streets supporting the government's policies, and the great young masses are standing by the revolution.
Maduro said the government is developing over 500 branches of the bank nationwide and more than 1,000 automatic teller machines for the National Bicentenario Workers' Bank. Experts say the Workers' Bank has an international significance.
Venezuelans are standing against any foreign intervention. This country's economy will not obey the ideas of capitalism.
The Venezuelan president also approved the creation of a commission to oversee recovered, occupied, or nationalized companies, improve productivity, and fight against economic warfare.
Our government has to build a whole new economy for socialism after years of destruction caused by privatization, capitalism, and neoliberalism. And we as workers stand by our government to rebuild our nation's economy.
Despite the recent measures to meet the workers' demands, some Venezuelans say they are still concerned about economic problems which remain unresolved.
There are still some real problems going on, like corruption, and all Venezuelans know the nation is being rocked by an economic war related to inflation and chronic shortages.
While the opposition accuses the government of failing to resolve problems such as inflation, socialists believe that President Nicolas Maduro is making significant moves to improve the economy. They also maintain that the National Bicentenario Workers' Bank will generate important benefits for the Venezuelan working class. Jesus Silva, Press TV, Caracas.
As the world braces for the grand jury's decision in the Ferguson, Missouri police killing of unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown last summer, not only is there a massive police presence on the streets, apparently even discussing it is considered by some to be a terrorist act. RT's Kevin Owen reports.
A U.S. Navy veteran says he's been sacked from his job at a hotel in St. Louis and branded a terrorist for posting pictures of a police buildup in the hotel's garage. The authorities are gearing up for potential trouble as the clock ticks towards a grand jury decision on whether or not to indict a police officer who shot dead black teenager Michael Brown in August in the suburb of Ferguson.
Went to work on Friday and got called in the GM's office, and he told me to remove the picture in the short video, in which I did. And then it was a normal work day after that. Then come Saturday, I get called back in the office, and the head of security for Drury was there. And he told me that I no longer will be employed with the hotel due to the fact that I posted the picture and the video on social media. Well, he actually called me a terrorist for doing it, and that I dishonorably served my country in doing so. We never have, you know, 70-plus Department of Homeland Security vehicles just sitting in a parking lot, you know, waiting for training. I mean, I live in St. Louis, Missouri, not near the East Coast where D.C.'s at. So I know they didn't. I knew they weren't doing training.
Well, on Monday, the governor of Missouri declared a state of emergency and dispatched the National Guard to Ferguson, which has been shaken by street violence since the death of Michael Brown. There's mounting fear that if the officer is not charged with either murder or manslaughter, there will be a new wave of clashes. The grand jury's decision is expected within days.
After the announcement that the National Guard would be sent to Ferguson and St. Louis region, some media accounts, as well as some veteran activists, pointed to the use of the National Guard to put down uprisings in a number of American cities during the 1960s, including Los Angeles, Detroit, and Newark, New Jersey. Lawrence Hamm chairs the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, and he was in Newark during the uprising in 1967. We spoke with him by telephone Wednesday.
The insurgency in Ferguson very much resembles the insurgency that took place in the 60s, what people call the riot of the 1960s. And of course, in 1967, you had the rebellion in Newark, in which the National Guard was deployed, and you had the rebellion in Detroit, which was not only the National Guard was deployed, but then the 82nd Airborne Division of the United States Army, 82nd Airborne, was also called in because in both Newark and Detroit and other places, the intensity of the insurgency was so great. So one difference is that in Newark and in Detroit, there was no official prior notification that the Guard was going to be called in before the rebellion started. So we have here a situation where the governor, before anything even gets started, is saying he's ready to deploy the National Guard. And then more than that, he said that the National Guard, the state police, and the local police, and all law enforcement agencies were going to act as one.
Yeah.
Which is very significant. And we saw that in the 60s. At first, there was a reluctance to call in the Guard. They thought they could, in Newark, New Jersey, they thought they could put the rebellion down with the 1,500-member local police force. That didn't work. They called in 700 state troopers, so the state troopers and the local police worked together, and that didn't work. Then they called in the National Guard. So you had the National Guard, the state police, and the local police. See, this is why we call it a rebellion and not a riot, because right. If it was just a riot, the local police could have handled it, and it would have been an incident that lasted for, say, a matter of hours. But this was a full-scale rebellion that lasted for days and took combined military and paramilitary forces to eventually quell, and that was the situation in both Newark and Detroit. But again, with the Detroit situation, you had the local police, the state police, the National Guard, and the 82nd Airborne. And what's really interesting is that the 82nd Airborne had been in Vietnam. So right. They essentially used the same military force that was being used to put down the revolution in Vietnam. They brought that unit into Detroit to put down the insurgency, the rebellion in Detroit. And I would say that from a contemporary basis, people have been talking about the militarization of the police force in Ferguson. And people have been talking about the militarization of police forces around the United States as if this is some new phenomenon. This is not a new phenomenon.
Right.
This is a phenomenon that essentially got started during the 60s, during... Right. The African American rebellions of the 1960s. This is when you begin to see the militarization of the police and the perspective on the part of those that control, that are in social control, the perspective that the military and paramilitary forces should act as one. This is what I was just riding with someone the other day, and we were in Plainfield, New Jersey. And I guess there's some kind of National Guard post or National Guard post or something like that in Plainfield. Sometimes you pass these guard posts and barracks, and sometimes they'll have military equipment out there. Like if you pass through Westfield, New Jersey, I've seen a helicopter, you know, from, I guess it was from the Vietnam period. It's permanently on display in Westfield. And then yesterday when we were riding through Plainfield, they actually had on display, like a monument, a half track. Now, a half track is like a small tank. I don't know if one, maybe two people can fit into it, but the half track was a military vehicle. It looks kind of like a tank, a small tank, and was used during the Newark Rebellion. And I know this because I saw them with my own eyes. I was 12 years old in 1967 when the rebellion broke out in Newark, New Jersey, and the Guard came right up into my community. I lived on 12th Street between 16th Street and 18th Avenue, and at the intersection of 12th Street and 16th Avenue, the Guard actually set up a military checkpoint, and they set it up at both ends of our block, so wow. You couldn't get on our street or off our street without being checked by the Guard. Wow. And they had these small, what they call half track, right. I guess because they're maybe half the size of a regular Army unit tank. So the use of the military and military equipment, you see this with frequency in the 1960s. And remember, it wasn't just the rebellion in Newark. It wasn't just the rebellion in Detroit. There were more than 1,000 civil uprisings in the United States between 1960 and 1972. Mm. In fact, a lot of people don't know that some of the highways that run through the black community today were highways that were constructed after these urban uprisings in the mid-1960s, because the regular roads really did not lend themselves to moving this heavy military equipment into the urban areas. So right now, if you come into Newark, New Jersey, and you come into the black part of Newark, which is like the South and Central Wards of Newark, if you come into Newark, New Jersey, you'll see a route called Route 78. That Route 78 runs right through the black community on the south side of Newark. Mm. Then you go on the other side of Newark, New Jersey, and they constructed a pretty popular highway called Route 280. 280 runs right through the west side of Newark. Right. So a lot of these highways, these interstate highways, were constructed after the rebellion so that the military and the military equipment could be moved more quickly into. Now, that's not the only reason why they constructed, but that was certainly one of the considerations, so that the military and military equipment could be moved more quickly into these urban areas. And since the rebellion of the 1960s, the military in the United States has, in fact, been preparing itself, been training for anticipated future disturbances. And remember that the rebellion did not stop in the 1960s. There hasn't been a decade since the 1960s where there hasn't been an uprising in a black community, whether we're talking about L.A., whether we're talking about Cincinnati, whether we're talking about Miami. All of these cities have had uprisings since the 1960s. There hasn't been a decade that there hasn't been an uprising. And what is the one feature that is consistent and that you see with Ferguson, Missouri? All of these uprisings, I would dare say 99%, if not 100% of these urban uprisings were sparked by incidents of police brutality.
Right.
Because that is the whip hand. That is the whip hand, the pain that black people experienced the most is the use of excessive force, unjustified shootings and unjustified killings by the police. And these incidents invariably have sparked uprisings, like the uprisings in the 60s and like what we have seen in Ferguson, Missouri.
Since the 1960s, that was the time that they invented the special weapons and tactics squads, the SWAT teams. That's right. And they started adjusting the culture, which had been strongly against the militarized police, at least the political culture, to accepting this. What they had an actual TV show that was a popular cop show called SWAT. Yeah.
That's right. And that show came on, I believe, in the early 1970s, after the period of rebellion during the 1960s. When I went back to college in the mid 1970s, one of the first politics courses I took, this was in 1974, the politics course run by a professor named H.H. Wilson, Prince University. One of the books he had us read in his politics course was a book called No Left Turn. Now, this book was published in the 1970s, and one of the things that this book laid out was the fact that you begin to see the centralization of military and paramilitary forces in the United States, the paramilitary being the police force, because one of the things that they experienced during the 1960s when they had to put down these urban uprisings in the 1960s was this kind of disjointedness. Although you needed the local police and the state police and the National Guard combined, you needed them combined to put down the urban uprising, they were not used to working together because the police have a very different mission from the military. The police are not supposed to be military.
Right.
And their behavior and their interaction with the civil population is supposed to be very different from that of the military. But now you have a situation where the powers that be, are being confronted with these uprisings, and they need everything they got to put the uprisings down. They need the police, they need the state police, they need the National Guard, and sometimes they even need the army to come in to put it down.
And you know what? You also have a condition. First, you have the legal architecture with the Department of Homeland Security, basically an architecture of integration, and you have a phenomenon that you had at the end of the Vietnam War. I was talking with someone yesterday, made me sorry that we were demanding back then bring the war home, because it has come home, only in a much different way than we envisioned. You have all these people that have been doing social control with the military in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, now on police forces, and using a lot of the same equipment.
That's right. And not only are they using the same equipment, they're using a lot of the same personnel.
Right.
A lot of the fellas that had to go and fight in Vietnam, what kind of jobs did they get when they came home? Many of them became police.
Right.
Many of them became, if you go and you survey the police forces and the state police, you'll see that many, not all, but you'll see that many of them have a military experience, have served in the armed forces. And a big wave of them came in after Vietnam.
Right.
So you have this overlap between the police and between the military. But what you needed now, even though you may have had an overlap in personnel, you needed now a more formalized structure. And what the author in the book, No Left Turn, laid out is how after these rebellions of the 60s, the barriers that had existed, because, we had laws like Posse Comitatus and other laws where the military is not supposed to be used against the domestic population. So now they had to put rules and regulations. They had to put chains of command. They had to put interlocking agencies and bodies that would interlock the police and the state police and the military. All of that had to be set up. And all of that began in the aftermath of the uprisings of the 1960s. Remember, these uprisings preceded the Vietnam, well, not actually, they ran parallel to the Vietnam War.
But they were bigger. They were larger before the anti-war movement grew. They grew together.
That's right.
It was the first wave.
That's right, because you had uprisings in Harlem in the early 60s,
right.
in Watts and in other places, Newark. In fact, people talk about the Newark Rebellion because, you know, it was one of the largest and most intense. But in fact, though, the Detroit Rebellion was even larger than the Newark Rebellion.
That's right.
And so people remember Newark and remember Detroit. But in New Jersey, the Newark Rebellion wasn't even the first rebellion. People talk about Newark, and you would think that it was the first rebellion, but it wasn't the first rebellion. Jersey City had a rebellion before the Newark Rebellion. In fact, every major urban area in New Jersey had a uprising during the 1960s, and some of them preceded the Newark Rebellion. In Plainfield, I just mentioned Plainfield, New Jersey.
Right.
In Plainfield, New Jersey, not only was it their uprising, there was an armory in Plainfield. And people that participated in the uprising broke into the armory and seized weapons.
Whoa.
During the armory. So, you know, the powers that be were well aware that, you know, if they continued to let this situation develop, that you would actually believe, that not believe, that if you continue to let this situation develop, that you could actually begin to see some type of revolutionary condition begin to arise in the United States. And remember, that was one of the express objectives of Hoover and the FBI, to, in fact, precipitate, to cut off the possibility of any revolution in the United States by infiltrating, destroying black organizations and black leadership.
Right.
These were the words of the COINTELPRO, to prevent the rise of a black messiah.
That's right.
That could, in fact, unite not only large sections of the black population, but also maybe even form alliances with other parts of the population for an even broader movement.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this, all of the physical, the legal, the policy, all of this stuff we see in the aftermath. You remember the LEAA, the Law Enforcement Administration, created by Nixon
right.
in 1968. The LEAA was set up so that it could provide funding to police forces around the United States so that they could beef themselves up for the job that the rulers had for them, you know, to put down all these insurgencies that were occurring and possible future insurgencies.
Right.
So this is what we're seeing in Ferguson, New Jersey. That was a Freudian slip. In Ferguson, Missouri, we're seeing now the result of all that had happened since 1960, and it's clear that the governor of Missouri, you know, they plan to put down any possible insurgency in Ferguson with all the firepower that they have.
What do you think people around the country should do as they watch what happens in Ferguson? I'm assuming that they're going to release the grand jury report like at 4 o'clock on Friday or something.
In New Jersey, now what we're saying generally is for people to protest the day after, but in New Jersey, we're calling on everyone to come to the Lincoln Monument, regardless of what the decision is. When the decision is announced, if the following day is a weekday, come to the Lincoln Monument at 5 p.m. If the following day, if the day after the grand jury decision is a Saturday, then we're telling people to come to the Lincoln Monument, North Jersey, at 12 noon. So if it's a weekday, 5 o'clock p.m., Lincoln Monument. If it's a Saturday, 12 noon at the Lincoln Monument.
I'm assuming you're asking people to do something like that around the country.
Yes.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.